Dharma talk for. Thank you. This is the first pure precept, not creating suffering. This precept is usually stated as not creating suffering or not creating attachments. I want to look at this precept as what is the opposite of suffering. No, not bliss. That's just another form of suffering. Perhaps equanimity. Equanimity is not the absence of feeling or some kind of zombie state, but rather an equilibrium found through wisdom. A balance that really comes from really paying attention without an agenda, rather an overall intention. Not creating suffering is really difficult. You'd think not, and yet even the best intentions can go astray. You might think you are doing someone a favor, but that is only based on our perception of others' needs. I'm speaking from my own experience of trying to help when I probably shouldn't have butted in. I try to respond more thoughtfully now. I'm also thinking of this pure precept as creating harmony. I often am finding myself looking for my notion for a lecture, the word or concept which I can hook onto to inspire my talk. In this case, I found it in the new issue of National Geographic. It is a series on AI, that dreaded designation. Or maybe that hopeful designation, or maybe both. In this case, it comes from Nova Scotia, where Suresh Neethirajan asked the question, how do we create harmony? He is studying computer-enabled animal interaction, using AI to monitor farm animals. He grew up on a farm in India, where he learned happy cows produce better, healthier milk. Thus, when they stopped producing, they were left to live out their lives on the farm as a thank you instead of going to the slaughterhouse. Suresh teaches computer science and agriculture at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. Suresh set out to gather data on chickens, cows, horses, pigs, and sheep, measuring both temperature, blood, cortisol levels, hormones, and heart rates with biosensors paired with audio and video footage, all fed through AI. In order to understand what it looks like when an animal is comfortable or unwell. For instance, he found chickens make fewer noises of distress when their habitats are cleaned with greater frequency. And so they did this. This is about how he goes about creating harmony. Farms can use this information that they have created to make better conditions, which has a socioeconomic result, more and better milk, eggs, and harmony. He keeps asking, how do we, that is people, plants and animals peacefully coexist. To not create suffering, we have to create something else like goodwill. When I wonder how a whole community can create goodwill, I am taken back to Samish Island, where we hold sessions in the Northwest. There, the Samish tribe used to live in a huge longhouse, which housed 1,000 people. They were famous for their potlatches, where everyone would gather to exchange something of value with others. Of course, this was outlawed by the settlers. The potlatches are all pictured in a series dedicated to telling this history in a corner of the dining room there. The Samish no longer live on Samish Island. Tim Burnett did locate some elders of the Samish and invited them to a ceremony where we honored them. They appreciated the ceremony, as ceremonies are respected and valued in indigenous cultures as a kind of reciprocity, as thanking ceremonies. We have a lot to learn from their elders, and we too revolve around ceremonies. Ceremonies to honor Buddha's life and his death, as well as Suzuki Roshi's passing. We have ceremonies to reflect monthly on our intentions for ethical behavior. That is the full moon ceremony. All these ceremonies can be seen as reciprocity, acknowledgments of our connection to everything in this world. Giving thanks to everything in Indra's net. This is creating harmony instead of suffering. We acknowledge suffering. We do not ignore it. We ask how we can alleviate this suffering. Buddha gave us the answers. We pay attention to our cravings as opposed to our needs. I mentioned attachments in the beginning of this talk. Let's examine our attachments. Are they something we consider as part of our definition of who we are or who we may be? We consider what it is to have no fixed or concretized self. The observance of our so-called self is constantly changing. Moment by moment, we are reinvented. Each breath is new. As we let go of the last breath, so can we let go of our attachments. I don't consider our need for food and sustenance to be an attachment. I'm talking about those things that we can ask ourselves just how necessary they really are. Those desires are what we cling to anyway. Quoting Suzuki Roshi, Dogen Zenji said, "Although everything has Buddha nature, we love flowers and we do not care for weeds." This is true of human nature. That we are attached to some beauty is itself Buddha's activity. That we do not care for weeds is also Buddha's activity. We should know that. So in love, there should be hate or non-attachment. And in hate, there should be love or acceptance. Love and hate are one thing. We should not attach to love alone. We should accept hate. We should accept weeds, despite how we feel about them. So for me, to kind of paraphrase Suzuki's teaching here, when I look at some beautiful scenery, I do so knowing that there are also toxic sinkholes in Louisiana as well. I do not picture them or replace the beautiful vision with them. I just know that I'm aware of them as well. This is a kind of non-attachment, a more total awareness that doesn't create suffering. Some versions of this pure precept worded as avoiding action that creates attachments. What else can we create instead of suffering? Let's examine wisdom. How can I create wisdom? Actually, this was my original question when I first encountered Buddhism as a new Zazen student over 50 years ago. Grow old. Okay, I didn't want to wait. I needed it now, as I was not acting wisely. I was brash and angry. I needed to chill. What better place than moving into a Buddhist temple? Practicing with others, sitting many sessions, Zazen practice, checking in with the teacher, listening to others instead of ignoring them. Talking with a teacher was the hardest, as he completely saw through me. Perhaps everyone saw through me, although it wasn't as obvious. This beginning was me at the Santa Cruz Zendo. There was also a good side to me, so that was what I had to concentrate on. Wisdom was slow to catch up to me. It certainly didn't come overnight, and I shouldn't even hint that I am wise now, but at least older. A while ago, we studied Dale Wright's book, The Six Perfections, Buddhism and the Cultivation of Character. In it, the sixth and final perfection is wisdom. Without this most important perfection, he maintains that the first five cannot be actualized. The first five can be understood and practiced with, but only the application of wisdom really brings them to fruition. Just to remember, they are generosity, morality, tolerance, energy, and meditation. He says that from the Heart Sutra, there is a point of view that will get you to wisdom, and that is shunyata, or emptiness. Wisdom is the capacity to envision and work with the emptiness of all things. Now, emptiness is a view about all positions one might hold, and the hope is that one can embody its meaning at a more profound level than the conceptual. By emptiness, we are simply saying that all things lack self-nature. Everything is in a state of flux, ever-changing due to causes and conditions. Everything is what it is in relation to other things. This is what we call dependent origination. It is not a nihilistic position or a negative term. I actually think of it as fullness, that is, being full of possibilities. To quote Dale Wright, wisdom is the ability to see how all things are empty in this sense and to transform one's relationship to everything accordingly. Mahayana Buddhists sought a fundamental transformation in the way they lived their lives by means of awakening from unenlightening ideas, habits, and practices. Mahayanists examined human beings in their totality and in the divided components, perceptions, feelings, concepts, volition, self-consciousness, only to discover that they are all empty of unchanging independent characteristics. Things exist just as they are. Even enlightenment is empty, and attaching to the idea of enlightenment is just another attachment, not profitable to hold on to. Things continually appear, change, and disappear. If a bodhisattva even perceives the perfection of wisdom, then he has fallen away from it. Becoming dogmatically attached to your current vision of enlightenment, therefore, is unwise. It is just another way to be stuck in place, another form of fearful grasping for security. Again, wisdom is the ability to see how all things are empty and to transform one's relationship to everything accordingly. Wright's words seem especially apropos at this time. Wisdom is the capacity to be disillusioned but not disheartened. So, as I search through poetry collections to wrap up this talk on not creating suffering, it seemed most appropriate to call up Norman's post-election poem to us. Would that words knew how, what to feel, to do, what the heart on the sleeve turned inside out with the terrible news, clean fabric. Soldier on, those parts of the body in whose darkness sanity resides, kindness as natural as wind, blows through to some shaft of light in which the truth scrolls show scraps and clear hints of what's to come. That's never as imagined. Humans have their many foibles, fear elicits, but the body marches forward ever, forward and round and round. This too passes, and passing refreshes. Every new moment's a promise that being human matters on a green and greening earth, and the trees hold steady. And finally, his introductory words to his invitation to us. An invitation to pay close attention to your life, your breath, your daily tasks, and relationships. Not to be baited into confusion and despair. You are alive in a world that's everywhere alive. Pay attention to this and to kindness. So, thank you all. And after a minute of silent reflection, I will turn this over to Jean for her reflections on this, our first pure precept. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Well, like you, I also look for what sparks my awareness as I am considering a talk. And this last week, I came across this beautiful quote from Kōbun Shinō, great teacher Kōbun, who was in our lineage. I think some of you may have actually known him and practiced with him. I know Jeff did in Santa Cruz. And this is a quote from him about the precepts. He says, we become transmitters of life light. The main subject is how to become a transmitter of that actual light of the precepts. Life light. Practice takes place to shape your whole ability to reflect the light coming through you and to generate and regenerate your system. So the light increases its power. Each precept is a remark about hard climbing. And maybe it's not always climbing up. Maybe it's also about climbing down. You don't use the precepts for accomplishing your own personality or fulfilling your dream of your highest image. You don't use the precepts in that way. The precepts are the reflective light world of one precept, that one precept which is Buddha's mind itself, which is the presence of Buddha. So in this week of what sometimes felt like darkness for me, I found encouragement in that quote, the precepts as lifelighters, as us as transmitters of that light, doing no harm to others or to ourselves, to refrain from actions that create attachments, vowing to avoid all actions that create suffering, to be of benefit to all beings, making every effort to live in enlightenment, vowing to refrain from all evil. So that word evil always sort of stops me in my tracks. It's not a word that I've used much in my life. When I looked up this week the etymological dictionary definition, the word goes back to Old English and it means wicked, sinful, anything that causes injury physically or morally. And then it adds this little note that says, this word is the most comprehensive adjective and expression of disapproval, dislike, or disparagement in the entire English language. So I actually heard that word used a few times this week. And I sort of dug back into my own history and realized that the only real concept I ever had of it was something that came from fairy tales about witches and monsters lurking in the dark forests and closets. And I was one of those kids who needed the light on after going to bed. I was really afraid of the dark. I didn't want others to see that fear or to think I was a baby. Not being able to clearly see the presence, if there was a ghost in the closet or a snake under my bed, I constructed a child's storybook of excuses and imaginative fibs, white lies about how brave I was to protect myself, to feel safe. And that nervousness and uncertainty of darkness, the fear of not being able to hide from danger, to be seen as vulnerable or incapable of defending myself, not feeling safe in my own skin, is probably the major reason why I came to Zen practice. And I felt some of that this week. I recently learned about a Buddha named Ashkobhya. I'd never heard of him before. He's a Buddha who sits with a mirror in the bardo between death and rebirth. That's his gift as a Buddha, to reflect back and shine the light on everything in our life, just as it is. Do not look away, says Ashkobhya. Do not avert your gaze. Do not turn aside. So, just as Jeffrey said, I also came to Zen, like most of us, out of suffering, probably afraid of what I would see in Ashkobhya's mirror. But I had a fierce desire to see myself and the world clearly somehow, not to hide, and then to forgive and let go of my childhood fantasies and my fibs, to look into the dark, to not justify whatever lies I told, and to learn clearly what's harmful, to face into my own beginningless anger and greed and delusion with compassion and wisdom, to vow to wake up in this practice of not causing or attaching to suffering. And because, as we've been learning in Norman's lectures on continuous practice, as as we've been learning from Norman in continuous practice, we know that the learning that we do about what is harmful, what is untruthful, is ongoing, and that it's acknowledging it and not averting our gaze that helps us in this practice and helps us be helpful to others. The title of one of our precepts texts, Waking Up to What We Do. I think she actually calls it Waking Up to What You Do, but I'm just going to say We Do. Says it all perfectly in just those six words. And as I thought of what I wanted to say in this talk, I kept asking myself, what's most harmful? What's harmful? Well, for me, I think not telling the truth. The very first Dharma lesson that the Buddha gave to his son, Rahula, was never to tell a deliberate lie, even in jest. He added that if a person feels no shame, telling a deliberate lie, that there's evil in that, and that that person will not stop at any evil. Obviously, the Buddha saw that this precept against lying, that precept against lying, in tandem with this one about not doing any harm, was crucial, essential. And as I thought about this first pure precept and decided to focus on the harmfulness of lying, I had to think back and admit, and even though this is not about true confessions, I have told a few real whoppers in my life that I'm not proud of, and countless small ones. I know firsthand they are poisonous. They can kill relationships. They can even affect lives beyond our immediate awareness and beyond our lifetimes, affecting the lives of others. And they can be passed on for generations, from parents to children, by historical texts, by laws, through fantasies and fears. The Buddha defined telling a lie as deliberately misrepresenting the truth. And for example, you did ask, but then you say you didn't, or you didn't see or didn't know something, but you say you did. And many people, when they learn of this definition, immediately look for two possible exceptions. One is, what about jokes when you exaggerate the truth, but without intending to deceive your listener? And then the second one, what about lies told with compassionate motives, such as wanting to protect people from truth they're not ready to hear, or to protect people from danger? Well, the Buddha's first lesson to his son explicitly rules out the first exception. The teaching he gave says that training the mind is a matter of becoming increasingly sensitive to your actions and thought, to your word and deed, to the intentions. What's motivating you? And if you see anything unskillful in your action, how do you best abandon it? Even if it's a joke, even if it's something you're saying that's meant to amuse and entertain. If you don't do it with the thought in mind of being sensitive and actually bringing rigorous honesty to how you frame your words, ultimately, you might find yourself trying to wiggle out of a truth or justify somehow hurting someone. It's really tricky what the mind does. And if we keep turning a blind eye, using jokes, using humor, we can really do great harm. The Buddha said, actually, in our sense of humor, there's plenty of humor there. We just have to be honest about it. A similar line of reasoning applies to the second exception about bringing compassion through deliberate lie or keeping something from someone, which is also a lie. That somehow our own idea of what is good for people is sometimes actually harmful. Maybe we think our compassion is in some way superior to someone else's. Maybe hiding our motives is a way of self-serving, making ourselves most important, rather than thinking what's a benefit to someone else. The best way is to find out what our genuine motives are. There are social consequences to our white lies as well, and it really is helpful to know what the genuine motive is when we do it. When people find out we've told a lie, no matter how compassionate we thought it might be, they'll never trust our words again, never. And when trust is broken, a relationship is usually pretty fatally broken, wounded. And when little lies become acceptable, bigger ones become more widely acceptable too. And society can, as a whole, break down just with little lies building into bigger ones. Maybe we can make a practice of pausing and saying, I need to think about it, or I don't know what to say, I'm not sure, instead of misrepresenting the facts about something I'm not sure about, or instead of trying to cover it up or trying to fool myself and others with something called a good lie, supposedly motivated by compassion. Usually, though, it's because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of something, and usually it's about this business of not looking like a fool or not looking like a baby. I'm back to the early days of my life. You may have experienced the actions of one person affecting the whole, and I have experienced that in my life when I've remembered a time when people in a whole community were affected by one person's actions. The result was suffering for the entire community, a lie that spread and was really confusing to everyone, where one person broke a huge precept. So fortunately, there's mindfulness to assist us, to remind us to value our life. The inherent nature of being connected, we cannot completely avoid in participating in harming others. The inherent nature of being connected doesn't guarantee that we can completely avoid participating in the harming of others. But we can say we are sorry, we can acknowledge it, and we can acknowledge that we all suffer and that we have all lied, and we can forgive. So with our precepts, we practice letting go. We practice becoming the transmitters of actual light, as Koban said, of life light. And we shine the actual light of precepts through our continuous practice, going beyond good and evil, harm and attachment, living in an awakened way. Waking up to what we do. So thank you for listening to my talk. Now, Jeffrey, what did we decide? I remember, but I'm going to ask you to ask. Oh, you're muted, Jeff.
Well, one question we might ask is, what can we create instead of suffering?
I am going to create breakout rooms.